Hi, and welcome to the Caribou Projects podcast. Caribou Projects is a contemporary arts organisation situated in the heart of Bedminster in Bristol. In this podcast, we aim to explore the area around us and bring to light stories that are surprising, interesting, moving, and uniquely rooted in Bristol. In this episode, we take a deep dive into the work of artists Sivin de Boal and Sarah Bolton. We join them for a conversation that discusses the themes of the latest exhibition at Caribou Projects, Javasu, and takes a wider look at the relationship between the two artists' work. This episode concludes with a composition made from sounds recorded in the gallery during the exhibition using items found around Caribou, including Savinda's wonderful pineapple instruments.
I was thinking we should mention this really nice microphone thing.
Yes.
Because it's made from tights and a coat hanger, is that right? And it is like sort of using something that's already in the world, which I was thinking kind of relates to your the stands that your works are on.
Yeah.
And the wood that you find and things like that. Maybe you want to talk a bit about like your ideas on how you put the stuff in the space and what you use. And
yeah. I love that microphone. Microphone cover made of stockings and coat hangers. I think I'd like to borrow it for my next solo show. Thank you. But yeah, often I find different objects around. I imagine myself to be a cinema pioneer, finding still images, and for me objects are still images as well. And so a lot of the work in this exhibition involves found imagery and also found objects. And the stands for the instruments, they're made from recycled wood, so pretty much everything in the show is found and altered in some way, and that's quite important to me.
And how do you see, I suppose, the sea monster? Was that found or did you draw that?
The sea monster is an amalgamation of images that I found in books or on the internet, or also photography as well that I'd taken. So the sea monsters actually have pineapple leaves as part of their fins that I've photographed. Tops from the instruments that have been used already. So there's a lot of recycling and iterations of different things, or echoes, I guess,
between
the works.
Yeah, recycling, yeah, as you say. We talked a bit before, didn't we, about how the sea monster was like used in ancient maps to articulate gaps in knowledge where they didn't know what would be there. So they just included a drawing of a sea monster like in the middle of these seas, which I guess were also described with like little curly waves on these maps. And I thought maybe a lot about both of our work kind of sort of does this thing where it surrounds, I guess, like the gaps in knowledge and like it, you know, time passing. And I think one thing we talked about was the pineapples. So they were illustrated first, like what, 400 years before they were tasted?
Yes, so they were illustrated in the 1600s. Mm-hmm. There were lots of lithographs and sketches of them, but they weren't readily available to the public until the early 1900s. So if you think, that's quite a number of centuries where people had to imagine what they tasted like. Or even more, for me, I'm kind of interested in where they imagined these things grew, like what kind of
lands
they were, and what that would actually look like as well. Because if you imagine what a pineapple looks like, you know, that's one plant in this amazing place.
Yeah, the scene that they are imagining. Yeah, exactly. This kind of, I suppose, the pineapple is like a symbol or like an object of imagination in a way. And it still kind of is, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's extremely charged with imagination.
Yeah. Maybe what we could talk about is how the pineapple thing, and how there were so many years between people knowing what it might look like versus knowing what it tasted like, and that sort of gap that was just held for 400 years in people's minds, or like in the minds of people, I guess. And then I was thinking about the fictional element of these faraway lands and how actually last night I did a happening in the space of your show. And I mentioned that I would have liked to have done it in Sunshine Cafe down the road, which is actually where we just recorded some background noise this morning.
And had a lovely coffee.
We had a lovely coffee. Thank you very much, Sunshine Cafe. And it was just quite interesting because it became like a fictional thing for people because it was in the context of, I suppose, an artwork. I don't know if that's what made it fictional, or I suppose just because it wasn't here, you can't see it.
We're in, you know, Bristol, Bedminster, and there hasn't been a lot of sun, so it could be like, well, you know, that's why is there a cafe called the Sunshine Cafe?
Yeah.
Around here, or is there even?
Yeah.
And some of the people last night were actually wanting to go and find it to see if it actually existed, which I thought was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those things that it can manage to put everything into a possible fictional realm. Once you start thinking, oh, well, is that real? Oh, well, maybe Caribou is also not a real character. And so maybe you could talk a bit about how you chose to literally go with Caribou as a character to outline or frame your show. And obviously this place is called Caribou and it's got its own narrative based on the myth of Princess Caribou anyway. But I suppose that you choosing to work with that myth is a bit like you choosing to work with recycled pineapple leaves on your steam monsters and the recycled wood that you find on the street.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I identify with Princess Caribou because, as I said, I imagine myself to be a cinema pioneer. So when I'm making my work, I actually become a cinema pioneer. And in a sense, I think that Princess Caribou also may have started off saying that she was a princess, and then people started to be convinced by her as a princess, and then she became that, and then she developed her own language, and she developed her own alphabet and things like that that were actually authenticated by academics. Like, she really managed to convince a lot of people at that time, which was the 1800s, that she was from a faraway land, the land possibly of pineapples. In fact, she did insinuate that she came from a land where pineapples existed by pointing to a lithograph in a local inn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there is that nice link there.
Do you think she was an artist?
Ooh, what is an artist? That's another...
I don't know if we should go down that road.
Yeah, maybe it's too late to ask her, I guess.
Yeah.
But I like the fact also that, you know, she was actually a maid before that. And so she was from a lower class, and she could convince the upper middle classes that she was this princess.
Yeah.
So there's so much about Princess Caribou that's rooted in the imagination that kind of links up this whole show with the sea monsters filling in gaps on medieval maps, for example, pointing to the unknown, and then the pineapple instruments, the pineapples leading to imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And what else have we got here? We have the flying machines.
Yeah, well, I was going to kind of ask about those because what I find really interesting is that obviously you invite people to carry them through the space and fly them themselves. But also they're installed really beautifully, really intentionally, like in these wooden sort of frames and spaces. And you can also imagine them working by looking at them. I mean, there's a lot you can't. They're amazing how they work. I still don't quite understand. But I think all of the work has this sort of seed-like element to it where you can see it and you can imagine it and you don't have to hear the pineapples. It's really amazing when you do, but that is something that I personally think is really great when art can do. You know, you see something and you can... It creates a huge open gap space in front of you for your mind to do the work, the rest of the work. So you can see the pineapples sitting there and you can kind of imagine them playing even if you don't hear it. And the same with the wings on the flying machines. What is your sort of, like, you do use quite a lot of paper in your work. Do you?
Yes, yeah. I do use a lot of paper.
Which, by the way, are the wings on the flying machines.
They're the wings on the flying machines, but they're also the propellers are made of Japanese paper.
Mm.
So I'm very much interested in paperweights as well. So the weights of paper, because obviously they do different things. As somebody who animates objects, a lighter paper will flap in a different way. So the wings, or the images of the wings on the flying machines, move differently depending on what paperweights you put on them. So there's a lot of research there.
Mm.
And also flight is a reoccurring theme in my work. I've also made a video of a flip book with identical images of a wing on it.
Mm.
And as you flick the book, it looks like the wing's flapping.
Not moving.
And that took me about 6 months to find the right paperweight to get the pages going. So I really... That is my... pursuit, as it were, to make movement out of these images, and often I end up using paper.
Mm. Mm. And figuring out the right weight, that's really interesting.
Yeah, there's a technicality to it, it's like, for me, there's almost something quite scientific about what I do as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
In my head, my imaginary head.
Yeah.
I'm sure a scientist.
Well, I think you're an inventor. I remember we spoke before and you said you were an inventor before cinema was invented.
True. But
that's what you said. I loved that. I've written that down. But I thought we could talk about a little bit about our sort of coming together to working together.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even thought about the wing thing, because in one of my texts, so I wrote 8 texts for Savinda's show, which was sort of related, but also my own work. But they really work well, I think.
Yeah,
in the
there's
context.
So many links between.
There's
our
so
work.
Many links, and the final one, which is just before you enter the space physically, is based on a story about a wing which I got and I coated in silver leaf and put in a back pocket of my rucksack before taking it on an airplane. And I suppose my a big part of my work is that I like to make things move as well, and I achieve it in actions and gestures and stuff, kind of private performances in a weird way, but then I write it out, or write it up, and I recount it in words, and I feel like that's sort of also putting things together in quite a crafted way, I suppose, in order to keep the wing moving in the writing, as well as it's not just a documentation of this thing that happened, it sort of keeps it going, transfers it to a different space.
And with your work, you have to be there to experience it, like yesterday's happening.
Yeah.
It was so poetic, if I can say that.
Yeah, and that's the aim.
You know, there are little echoes and gaps between people telling stories to one another. I'm not going to say too much, because I think I quite like the fact that your work's so ephemeral. But it also instigated so many conversations that other people had about imagination.
Yes.
Which was so fantastic for me to witness, like these little interventions that you make that started to create echoes and then ripples and then became something even bigger, and then it dies down and then it starts again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Which I quite like. And again, that's what the flying machines do. They start flapping and then they...
Yeah, exactly.
The movement goes to still and then... Yeah. Well, in all of my work, so...
And it's related to the person that is... it's related to the moment. In my work, it's literally related to the moment and the time and the evening, but it's also related to the moment of the person walking with this thing and then they stop. So it's kind of about, being present as well, I think, and being held by the people that are experiencing it.
Mm.
So literally with your work, it's being held, the wing, the flying piece is being held and it's walking, and then the human stops walking and then the piece stops working.
Yeah.
So it's, I suppose, a way of keeping things moving.
And people were saying today about being present that they didn't check their phones yesterday, and they're wondering whether that was just because they're in the gallery or because of the work.
That's correct.
Because they wanted to verify certain things. So someone said, oh, does Princess Caribou exist to someone who just asked me, does Sunshine Cafe exist? And then there's a whole conversation. Normally, if that was in a pub or something, you'd look on your phone.
Yeah, and then maybe get distracted by 100 other things and
exactly
scroll through something or other. Yeah.
So it was really great. There was a beautiful moment about those phones, though, because people really wanted to check, like, fact and fiction, and then they wouldn't. And then they got to a point where we were all thinking, are we just making things up anyway?
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, because what is, like, not what is real, but...
Yeah. And that actually, there's something quite refreshing that you could use your imagination. I think...
Yeah.
Generally, what's being insinuated is, because of the phone and being able to check, that you're not allowing your imagination to take you somewhere. We would get really nervous if we're like, oh my God, you know, like I did, like I can't remember when Princess Caribou was born, or for example, does it matter?
Not in context of, no, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It doesn't matter.
But in Google world, in Wikipedia world, it matters. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like that thing of when there's a positive thing, like an answer or a fact or something, you feel that you have to glue yourself to that because it's gluing itself to you, whereas maybe if there was an open space, like a negative void or whatever, a gap, then it doesn't matter. It's like a different sort of thinking and a different sort of interpretation or like level of productivity for the mind. I think it's really good to have the open spaces.
And I think on that, I think we do need a bit of a gap. So let's record a gap. Yeah. That's a gap.
And a gap is what we wanted at the beginning, was to have gaps, because the reason you asked me to be involved was because you read that tweet about the gaps between the trees.
Yes. I did, and I loved it.
Yeah, which was... someone breathing out between every gap in a particular row, when you see, like, on a hill or lining two fields, you see rows of trees that have gaps in them, kind of evenly between, and it's about a person walking between those trees and breathing out into every gap or every space. But I think it was also the way I wrote it. You were quite, that was like,
why? There's something about your work that allows me to imagine. I think that's what I kind of was insinuating that I liked. There's a lot of text works that I can't really... I have to keep going over the sentences over and over again. I don't really absorb them very well. But with your work, it just took me to places.
I suppose it's because it's imagery.
Yes, it is. It's very similar what we do in different ways.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense whatsoever. But often with your work, I can conjure up the image very, very quickly. And I've also made work with rows of trees that I haven't actually put up, but I did work for about 6 months on trees and gaps.
Yeah.
So when I read what you written, it was like, oh my God, this is the work.
Yeah. This is a person who can just carry on my work.
Yeah, exactly.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Caribou Projects podcast. To find out more about us, please go to www.caribouprojects.com, follow us on the usual social media channels, or pop in to visit us on Stafford Street in Bedminster. If you'd like to hear more of these podcasts, subscribe to our feed and you'll receive each episode as and when.